Welcome to Critical Eye's Inspiring Leaders podcast, our series where we speak to executive and non-executive directors about what's really going on in boardrooms today, getting insights into the key issues around strategy, stakeholder management, leadership capability and board dynamics. My name is Mark Barber, Director of Content at Critical Eye, and I'm delighted to have two Critical Eye board mentors with me here today. We have Sally Bridgeland, whose roles include being Chair of Impact's Asset Management, Annette at the Pensions Insurance Corporation, and until recently, you were Annette at Royal London as well. And joining Sally, we have David Guise, who's had a number of non-executive director roles and is currently an advisor for a range of businesses as well. In his executive career, David was a HRD for two FTSE 100 companies and one ASX top 10 listed company. So welcome, Sally and David.
Thank you very much.
Okay, quite a few things to cover today, but I guess it is that sort of time of year where people do a bit of crystal ball gazing, and my word, there's a lot, I guess, to sort of take on and reflect on. But in terms of, I guess, questions around the outlook for the next 12 months from a Chair and Ned perspective, what's your view, I guess, from a board, from looking at this through the lens of being on a board, what would your predictions be for what you're seeing over the year ahead? David, who wants to take that first?
I'll go. I mean, I think it's tempting to now list a long list of uncertainties and potential negatives.
Yeah.
I won't do a long list, but I mean, to state the obvious, the world's in a very uncertain place at the moment, not least because of the geopolitics of Ukraine, Middle East, who knows about China and Taiwan and other issues like that. We've also got a lot of elections happening around the world this year. US, UK, India, and several others. So there is understandable uncertainty, I think, about that. Having said that, you know, an individual board, an individual chair, CEO, can't impact a lot of that. They certainly need to be aware of it and understand potential implications on their business. But I think to a large degree, have got to work out how do they focus and prioritise. If you go a bit narrower to the UK, but not solely the UK, you know, there are reasons for some optimism versus 23. Energy prices have gone down and are stabilising. Interest rates may not go down as rapidly as some would hope. Inflation certainly has gone down, and I suspect the government in the budget will deliver some form of additional tax cuts. That's a prediction rather than a fact. So I think there's a little bit more optimism in that, but that's all overshadowed, I think, by some of the global uncertainty that we're all having to live with. And we haven't even touched on technology and other issues, environment, climate, etc. So there's some big, you know, some big stuff out there. I'd probably go into 24 feeling roughly as the same as I did going into 23, actually. It would be my net of all that.
Okay, all right, thank you. We had our Chair and Ned retreat last February, and obviously you touch on technology, it's clearly important, but it was amazing sort of from February afterward, like where AI just dominated the agenda, and at that Chair and Ned retreat, it wasn't really quite there, it was talked about, but then it just sort of came at you, and I guess that's what happens at the moment, isn't it? There's just a shift, and then it starts to dominate the agenda very quickly. Sally, could I come to you and get your thoughts on
certainly
this?
Certainly. Well, I think from the Chair and Ned perspective, obviously what you're trying to do is to oversee how the executive implement whatever strategy they've got. And to me, more than ever, there are two things. Encouraging the executive to think about different scenarios and particularly making them well-equipped to plan for the worst. So what are the contingency plans? If things get worse, how do we change headcount? How do we respond to threats or incidents or business continuity? Being more ready for that, but obviously hoping for the best. So being ready to take the opportunities should they arise. So I think gone are the days of having a budget where you're expecting to keep to the budget. You know you won't. Mm. But what does good look like? What does the upside look like? What does the downside look like? And how do you have to change the tiller and respond between board meetings over the course of a year?
And has that scenario planning then increased, would you say?
I think definitely. I mean, in my homeland of insurance, it's something that's fairly familiar, but I think all businesses are having to do more of that now.
Okay. Is that, if you like, weighting the conversation more towards risk as opposed to looking at where the opportunities are?
Yeah, I think it's about not seeing risk and the risk register as being kind of something that's on a shelf somewhere that you wheel out every now and then, but more it being that complementary side of things. So having to take risk deliberately, playing to your strengths, but knowing that you're taking on risk to get the good results, as well as taking actions to avoid the downside, and really thinking about what both of those paths look like. Yeah. So that if there are actions that are going to be valuable on both paths, those are obvious, those are no-brainers. It's the ones where you really are deliberately taking a positive risk that you hope is going to be rewarded, or accepting a negative risk. That's where the board's focus can really help the executive.
And to put you on the spot a little, do you have an example of where those kinds of conversations occur?
I think it's coming in around cyber and the conversations about consumer duty and operational resilience at insurance companies. So we talk about impact tolerances, important business services. You know, what are the things that really matter, and how badly wrong could it go? How late could you be in a payment to a policyholder? Again, those are things that are getting very clear, and the conversations get very detailed with executives at insurance companies, where actually bringing things to life. So if a cyber risk or a ransomware attack happened, exactly how much would you be prepared to do, or for things to be offline? Where are those resiliences, rather than it just being a general heading on some risk register somewhere?
Would you pay, for instance?
And working that through in advance.
At the end of last year, I had a fascinating conversations about the risk around cyber with quantum computing and what that comes
Blind.
Through.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I think is a separate podcast, but
that was like, and I may not be the right person.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure I am either. But I was like, this will come back, so I can see that.
Well, if I could, perhaps I could just build
please,
on that. I think as well as all the good scenario planning that I agree with Sally about, you know, the underpinning capability you're trying to develop both in individuals and organisations is agility. And you know, I spent a lot of my career trying to help very large organisations become more agile. Nice word, difficult to achieve. And your start point is helping the executive become more agile. Scenario planning and all the things that Sally talked about as part of that. But it's also about just the inner confidence and capability of doing that. Varies by individual and by organisation. I mean, I do a lot of work with retailers, and a practical example I would give that's a bit different is, you know, if shipping lines were disrupted because of the Middle Eastern crisis, and if that escalated, you know, a lot of clothing product is manufactured in Asia. And if you're flying it over, you're paying too much money. It's on containers. And if shipping lines were affected, then that could fundamentally alter, for example, the clothing business in the UK. So what are our contingency plans to deal with that? Because that might happen. That's quite a real world sort of, you can touch and feel that issue quite easily, I think, as an end consumer or customer of those businesses. So I think, you know, we've talked a lot about organisational agility, I think, over time. But how many, particularly the larger organisations that are publicly listed, how many truly are? Now, I think COVID has had to develop that muscle in dealing with the COVID crisis. And therefore, I think in some ways, organisations are probably slightly better placed than they were 4 or 5 years ago. But nevertheless, it's an uncomfortable feeling. But you're looking for leaders who understand things could change very quickly, very rapidly, you know, it in a way that you can't control, but you've got to be able to react to.
Yeah, and it's not, I don't take it as a given that our current governance structures are really responsive enough to cope with that. If you think about, most companies had to do a lot of extra board meetings and ad hoc this, and you wouldn't want to be doing that on a routine basis. However, you do need to make sure that the executive have got that muscle memory of how to deal with a crisis, but also how to be agile enough to take those positive opportunities as well.
Okay. And you think that falls on the board as well too?
I think it falls on the board to make sure, on behalf of whatever shareholders are out there, you'll want to get the returns and you want to avoid some risks and sort of operating within that parameter. If you haven't got the right skills around the executive to do that, it definitely falls on the board to do something about it.
Okay. Is that something that you're seeing in terms of executives struggling in this environment? Because I'm almost resistant of that term, agile, because I think it is used so often. But I do get it. I do understand. It's that you've clearly got, you know, in the retail space, huge short-term pressures that are going on. Still challenges in the workforce that are ongoing as well, and questions around the culture you're trying to create and delivering on the numbers.
To me, it's more about operational resilience optionality. So not being so tied down to one particular path that you've closed off the other possibilities. The opposite of agile, not necessarily the opposite of agile, but some organisations might have got so lean that actually they haven't got enough muscle to be able to move to other paths.
Okay.
And that's what you're making sure that in tailoring a budget and tailoring a strategy, that you're not closing down the resilience that you might need in this kind of environment.
We had an external speaker earlier who was very interesting, and my ears pricked up when he said, you know, we're no longer dealing with the benign conditions of the last 30 years. I think he meant up to COVID, and that encompasses, you know, most of my executive career. I had no idea I was operating in benign conditions.
Boom,
that was a surprise. But I think his point was well made. If you've been an executive, or indeed a member of a board, who's operated in the 30 years up to, let's call it, 2020, up to COVID. Although you think you've been dealing with some crises, and you probably have, his point was that's nothing compared with the continuous sense of, change that we're now dealing with. And I think that was quite a good point. So why would we expect each of us as individuals or as collectives to be fully equipped? I don't expect us to be. Therefore, talking about it, planning for it, and developing that muscle continuously is required.
So I think one of the big shocks at the moment is just access to finance, right? The cost of capital has gone up. If you're operating in PE, that's a huge, shift. And how you forecast your business models, your rates of return. And is that... if you historically, that's probably a more normal environment to be operating in. So the past, you know, 20 years will have you more of an aberration, if you like. So it's a big adjustment, isn't it, that's going underway. And then again, come back to the workforce culturally, what's shifting the expectations of employees? How are you thinking about productivity? You've got some sort of big things to be grappling.
Yeah, and also if you're a an employee in the middle of an organisation, I'm thinking again in retail, it might be a buyer, for example, core to the supermarkets business, to clothing, general retail. Actually, most of them haven't, until the last couple of years, haven't operated in an inflation environment that's been anything other than very low, and an interest rate environment that was also incredibly low. And as some people have pointed out, actually, the current levels of both are more the norm over time, over the last, you know, since the Second World War, than the last, the sort of 20 years leading up to, you know, a couple of years ago. That's a big change for people having to do their jobs in that environment.
But then you've got people like me, where my first mortgage was at 14% and inflation was 10%,
right,
you know, back in the 80s.
Yeah.
That's where, I hate to say this, where the grey hairs actually can mean you've seen more, been there, done that.
Which is what you do need in boardrooms as well.
Not just, I mean, you do need the people. And again, one of the other things that we were talking about earlier was technology and having that fluency and that understanding of what it can mean and could be. You need that range of experiences and attitudes and perspectives around the board table as well.
Okay, I mean, I think that does lead quite nicely into the next question. Like, given the landscape that we've described, and I'm sure that everyone listening to the podcast will recognise, how do you keep yourselves informed as independent directors, as advisors? How do you keep yourselves relevant, I guess, to the conversations that you need to be having with executives?
I mean, one thing I always looked for in people who either work for me or work with me was a level of inquisitiveness. So I think it sort of starts with, are you inquisitive? And if you are, you make it your business to stay informed. And that, you know, that clearly is reading a lot and reading outside of your own particular industry to the macro environment, other industries, what's happening. Networking with people who you work with anyway or outside of that, and also actually if we just link that to mentoring, you know, I say at the start of a relationship with my mentees, we obviously introduce each other and ask them what are their objectives out of this relationship. And then I say, well, can I just spend a minute on what's in it for me? And what's in it for me is that I'm intentionally interested in businesses that I don't know much about or set. So because I'm not always, in fact, I'm very rarely mentoring people who happen to have worked in the background that I had. It's often in different industry sectors, in businesses I don't know that well. And that interests me. So that's another way that, you know, of keeping informed. Obviously, I'm mentoring them. That's the primary task. But in doing so, the context within which they're operating is hugely helpful. And, you know, as a general rule, certainly as an HR director who moved across different sectors, the issues are not that different within organisations. That sometimes people push back about that because obviously there's very industry specific context. However, which is fascinating. However, the actual tasks of leaders, of boards, of leaders in those businesses, when you cut everything else away, is not as different as people think.
Yeah, there are some universal themes, I guess, around the people element of leadership.
Not just the people element, you know. There shouldn't be a business that isn't stopping and thinking, I'm sure they all are, about what the impact of AI is or should be and what's the opportunity in their particular business. There shouldn't be any business that isn't thinking about the environmental and climate stance that they should be taking, etc., etc. There's some very applicable themes across every business in every sector, albeit the context within which they operate, regulatory or otherwise, is different.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I mean, the danger, and I know this from having been the kind of person that produced newspaper fodder in the past, is that kind of everything that's published is history, and your job as executives and non-executives is to help the businesses find their way into the future. So keeping curious, keeping imaginative, not trying to learn everything, but knowing what the questions are. And I find actually having enough of a profile on social media and whatever brings things to me. I have coffees with people who occasionally you sort of think, blimey, I didn't know this was out there or this was happening. And it just gives you a whole load of different questions that you can ask to the business, to the people that don't have time to have those cups of coffee. And that is as important as anything else that's sort of formally published in any way. So it's the networking. So at the moment, I'm really interested in what's going on in space, the lower Earth orbit, manufacture and renewable energy, and the things that will be there within the next 5 to 10 years. And will every business be a space business in some kind of sense? And just having that kind of curiosity and imagination can help you think about some of the risks of wedding ourselves to a terrestrial way of doing things. Even if it doesn't go that way, the reality is there's been huge changes in that domain, and you're open to what comes your way, really.
Okay. David,
I'd add one other point, which I think it's quite easy for those of us who've operated or still deal with large corporations. I spend a bit of time deliberately talking to small business owners, because I think that offers a different set. They don't necessarily have a boardroom. They might be an owner manager of a business of 20 to 100 people, and it's always good to get their perspective, because often what's on their mind is perhaps slightly nearer in, perhaps more immediate, but still as valid. And I think it's just a good wake-up call occasionally for those of us who are in large corporations, that there's a bunch of people for whom our economy actually thrives if it's doing well. Those people are the ones who are really helping drive it. And it's just a really good sort of back to basics, that's unfair, but just a sort of wake-up call about some of the core pressures of running a small or medium-sized organisation, which if I didn't do that, I wouldn't really be exposed to. Mm. I find that very helpful.
Yeah. What would some of those core pressures be?
Well, I mean, if I go back to COVID, for example, chatting to someone I know who runs their own financial service advisory business, I said, well, have you applied for one of these loans? He said, I don't want a loan. If I've got a loan, I've got to pay it back. That's of no great practical help to me unless I'm so cash strapped I need it. So, yes, he did use the furlough scheme, but the government was championing loans, and I'm sure that was useful for some people, but, he's a savvy guy who said, I don't want a loan. That's of no great benefit to me whatsoever. So it's some of those pressures.
The cash flow element to it.
Yeah, correct. I mean, but that's a well-run business with a decent cash flow. But some of those pressures are quite immediate and quite hand to mouth, but actually is it just a good wake up call to remind oneself what it's like to run a small and medium sized business as opposed to some of the very large corporations, which don't have unlimited resource themselves, but clearly, hopefully, in many cases, have a lot more resource to call upon.
Okay, thank you. Just in terms of, so you're joining us at our Critical Eye Board Mentor Away Day, and stepping out of one of the sessions that's just started, actually, so thank you for that. And I'm mindful that we do need to get back to it as well. But again, obviously, without naming names or specific companies, but would you say there are any particular themes that sort of jump out in terms of what executives are grappling with at this sort of current moment in time?
I think there's, and this is a sweeping generalisation, and different circumstances will vary, but that feeling of being overwhelmed and that not knowing how to deprioritize the things that aren't going to be important, and that's where that's one of the issues. The other one is people's sense of what's important to them, and their sort of sense of self and their sense of priorities and values has changed during COVID, and the possibilities have been opened up by hybrid, flexible working have changed. The meaning of a career has probably changed. And so it's less obvious that, in the same way as you might, I was going to say O-levels to A-levels, but GCSEs to A-levels, just O-levels.
I think it's changing again.
There's a less obvious path than there might have been, than somebody might have had when they were joining an organisation and their next goal was to be promoted to the... There are more deep questions being asked as to, well, why would I want that job anyway? Which requires you either to help them decide to be brave and do it and develop skills that they might not have, or that actually it's not the right thing for them, and they should go off and do something else or take a different path. And the role of the mentor is not to tell them, because you never know them well enough, but to help them ask the right questions so that they can find out why they would and why they wouldn't, or why they think they would and think they wouldn't. But sometimes being a mentor is much more like being a two-year-old, where you just ask why, until you get to a sensible answer, because it's, I want this. Well, why?
Yeah.
Because I can make more of a difference. What do you mean by making a difference? You know, why do you want that in your life? And why is it you that can make that difference? And what responsibility have you got to make that difference?
Giving them to break it down, reflect, and if this is a value of yours, what does that really
mean? In this uncertain, overwhelming environment, when do you have the space to have those conversations? It's really only when you have the conversations with your mentor. So you've really got to make the most of that short time you've got available to go quite deep, quite quickly.
Thank you. I think that the uncertainty, complexity that we've talked about leads to an intensity of people's working lives that means, you know, I think a good mentoring relationship hopefully is a bit of a release from that and a bit of space to talk to someone hopefully they've built up trust with, who's nothing to do with the organisation, and the conversation won't be repeated. And, you know, a lot of my conversations are listening to the things they're very busy on and then asking, you know, as Sally said, you know, why is that important? And what I'm trying to do is to help them prioritise. And so how do you turn that intensity to that actually something positive for the organisation they're in? And that's actually proved, you know, pretty fruitful actually in some of my conversations, as in they have literally stopped doing some stuff or they have delegated it. And I was saying earlier that one of the techniques is a very simple one, which is go back over your diary over the last month. You don't have to do it for me. Just and stare at what you did, what meetings you attended, what you were involved in, and ask yourself, did I need to be there? Because the constant refrain otherwise is, I haven't got time, haven't got time, haven't got time. And I get that. I've been there myself and didn't always manage it very well, by the way. But trying to help the person prioritise and make choices, sometimes tough choices about what they get involved in or not, is definitely a big theme. I think to Sally's point about sometimes if there's someone in a really quite a bad place, it's often either they're not really aligned with either the board or if they report to the CEO, or they're not really aligned to the core purpose of the organisation. Now that's less common, but occasionally can happen. Sometimes you have to tease that conversation out and actually then, you know, get into a conversation about that person's worth, because often they're more valuable than they realise in those circumstances because they're under the cosh. This is rare, but it can lead to the person deciding, actually, this is not the place for me. I would never tell someone that. I want them to either reach that conclusion or not, but not stay in the sort of limbo of being, you know, possibly very unhappy or not aligned to the organisation or their boss. And trying to sort of manage through that in a slightly agonising way, I'd rather they reflected on it.
Mm. I guess thinking about the optionality around the situation that they're in. Going to your own executive careers, did you have a mentor, someone who you went to, who looking back you regard as a key figure, who helped you think differently about yourself, about what you could achieve, and who made a difference?
Several. And different people taught me different things. There was one very influential one that was really helpful in making me realise two things. That I wore different hats, and it helped me to articulate which hat I was wearing and which perspective I was coming from when I was in a board or an executive meeting. So as chief executive, I would say this. As a trustee of the pension fund, I would say this. Both of those perspectives are equally valid, but they lead to completely different answers. As the executive, I know that if we try and do what I want to do as a trustee in a strategic non-executive role, this is where I want to take the company. As the executive, I know the wheels will fall off if we do that. But it's best to try, and the other thing is, articulate both those perspectives rather than trying to reconcile themselves in your own head. And in terms of how that reflects in my mentoring style, it's let's try and get as many perspectives out onto the table as possible, because that might help you resolve them. And speaking from my own experience of my other experience of a wonderful mentor that I had, was that usually I knew the answers And his role was asking the questions that meant that I would articulate the answers and realise that I had it in me only way. So not only did I answer the questions, but I built confidence that I knew the answers. And instilling greater confidence, is, I think, is one of the greatest gifts. And independence is the greatest gift that a mentor can give a mentee.
Yeah, I mean, similar to Sally, I've had several mentors, and I think the overriding sort of underpinning characteristic was obviously one of trust. So I trusted them to always give me straight advice, I guess, however comfortable or uncomfortable that was. But actually it was born of, I knew that they were interested in me and me succeeding. And that's fantastic to feel that someone who's giving of themselves to do that. Perhaps more interestingly, actually, as I was thinking, as Sally was chatting, I have a mentor who may or may not regard themselves as a mentor, interesting, because it's very informal, who effectively was a peer of mine, actually, and has since gone on to other things, probably a little bit more experienced than me, and thinks a bit differently from me. And I really value that person's perspective. And it is a sort of mentoring relationship without ever being formally established that. And we haven't worked together for many, many years, but actually if there was someone I would turn to for a bit of advice about, it could either be a career move or engaging with a certain organisation, whatever it might be, I'd always value their perspective. And again, I know advice is going to be given in a very confidential way. And, you know, we're friends, so it's completely trustworthy. So that's quite interesting as I thought about it. Actually, one of my better mentoring relationships is with someone who effectively was a peer of mine.
Okay. Do you think, again, we've had conversations at Critical Eye, you hear about the chair being a mentor for the CEO and the support that non-executive directors can provide to executives. Does that really happen? Because I guess fundamentally the chair can fire the CEO, and you've always got a responsibility and accountability based around performance to shareholders. Just sort of thoughts around that, how you get that, because you don't want the relationship to be adversarial. There's no point in that. You want it to be as constructive and healthy as possible, but just sort of thoughts around that from a sort of board.
Well, it's very rarely the first choice that you fire the CEO, because there's an awful lot of disruption when that happens. So is that going to be in the shareholders' interests? Unlikely. So if you have got a relationship where, and this is really bad radio, you've got the board on one side of the table, the executives on one side of the table, and the non-executives on the other side of the table, and they're facing off against each other, the chair is the one who has to take the marriage guidance counsellor's role in trying to find a way through that. And that usually will start with the chief executive as the leader of the executive team. It also might mean that you end up having to be a bit of a yin and yang, you know, whatever the chief executive's strengths are, the chair has to complement those if they've got some blind spots, making sure that you fill that in. The difficulty can become is if that relationship gets too close, and then that means that you're not objective in assessing the performance. So it's getting the right amount of empathy, but not getting too in each other's pockets, so that you can remain sort of detached. And I was told at the start of one executive role when I had some psychometrics that I'm off the scale as far as independence goes. So maybe I've got that naturally, it sort of comes to me okay, but that would be the thing to watch out for, I think, for any non-executive is to, how do you know that you're staying independent if you're an independent director?
Which comes back to this point around having the perspective.
Yeah, and it's a mindset, and not wanting to help, wanting to find out, not wanting to be liked by the executive. That's more egotistical than non-egotistical. So watching those, you know, why am I saying what I'm saying? It's quite a tightrope to walk.
Yeah, I think you're right, Mark, to call out the seeming ambiguity between, you know, a chair being a mentor, we'll come back to that point, to the CEO, but also holding him or her to account for performance. And that I think can produce a dichotomy, and therefore I wouldn't describe, I think at certain moments in certain parts of certain conversations, the chair is absolutely acting as a mentor to the CEO, and that's appropriate. But in other situations, they're playing a different role. They're holding a exec team to account for performance. They are thinking about some of the external issues that they may have experienced in other organisations that they might be on the board of, and bringing those into that business, etc., etc. So I think the key difference is versus an external mentor is obviously they are in the organisation, albeit as a non-executive chair. They are in a line of command. And so I think, you know, you have to note that difference. But it doesn't preclude, I think the underpinning requirement is to get to know that person really well, not as a friend, but really understand what drives individuals and how one can help them.
Yeah.
I think that's different from purely calling oneself a mentor. I think that may be one part of many roles the chair is playing with the CEO.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think with the chair, you know, always talked about as being critical friends. There's a balance between the critical and the friend, depending on if the chair is overconfident, you might need to be, the chief executive is overconfident, you might need to be more critical. If they're underconfident, you might need to be more friendly and supportive. Whereas a mentor is much more of a professional friend. You really are, you have got the interests of that person at heart, and you're trying to make sure that they give of their best.
Mindful of time, so I'll wrap it up here. But just finally, thoughts, right? There's a lot of conversation around how executives need to change. They need to be more agile. They need to, again, sort of be able to operate in this landscape of continuous disruption, or whatever we want to call it. How do you think chairs and NEDs need to change? Because obviously there are governance procedures that they need to follow, there are standards, oversight, there are ways of reporting, you've got an audit committee, REMCO, dealing with shareholders. But what fundamentally do you think there's something that needs to sort of shift or change in boardrooms as we sort of move into, I guess, a slightly different business landscape?
I think there's something about being more imaginative and being more long-term. So it is less about the holding executives to account for this year's numbers, and more about holding executives to account for the state of the business at the end of the year. So you can get the numbers, but at what cost? Is it still as resilient? Has it got the optionality it might need in the future? Whether you like the word agile or not, you know, those kinds of characteristics. Have you left the business in a better place at the end of the year? And you need a different kind of imagination to think through those different paths. And I think there is just something more about personal empathy that hasn't, and just the sort of watching and understanding the dynamics of the executive team and their strengths and weaknesses, and making sure that encouraging them to build on those. It's much more. There are quite a few things I've gained from my parenting course that I end up applying in the boardroom that really did surprise me. Sort of praise is magic rather than sitting people on the naughty step, and, you know, being really careful about how you deliver messages, particularly in this uncertain time, and, you know, conscious of the importance of the well-being, the mental well-being of people around the table and the decisions they're having to make.
Okay.
I think the chair NEDs should always have be bringing an outside-in perspective. That was the case, you know, 20 years ago. However, I think it's more incumbent upon them to do that now, a bit more proactively, as opposed to a bit more consciously, as opposed to, oh yes, I came across this in another company. It's more consciously, I can bring this to the table and help this organisation with a different perspective that I think will be valuable. So I think, to a degree, that hasn't changed, but I think it should be more conscious now. I think there's an interesting, again, potential dilemma, which I don't think is a dilemma at all, between letting the executives do the job, clearly, but that doesn't mean at the expense of scrutiny when appropriate. And I guess I've got the post office ringing in my ears as I'm giving this example, but actually there's no rule that says the non-exec shouldn't be scrutinising stuff when appropriate, in some detail. That's different from doing the job. And obviously the critical skill is the judgment to know when to scrutinise and when not to, because you can't be scrutinising everything. So I don't think that's gone away. In fact, you know, with the governance environment, legal environment, global environment we have, I think it's even more required to have that judgment than it would have been, you know, several years ago. And I would finish on the more personal stuff, because I think, you know, I think leadership has evolved, and thinking about leadership has evolved now to the point where having a deep level of empathy for the human being is important, and really knowing that person, and to Sally's point, knowing what drives each of us as individuals is critical. And I think the days of non-execs or chairs being a somewhat distant, you might not meet with them frequently, it doesn't mean they shouldn't know you really rather well and know what, you know, what drives you. And I think that is incumbent upon them in a way that probably wasn't quite the case several years ago.
Okay. Well, I think I am on multi-step here, so I will wrap it up here. And thank you.
Sorry,
no, it's all right. Thank you, Sally, and thank you, David.
Thank you, Rob.